Well, last Sunday morning we witnessed the glory of Christ. Today we continue that theme. Ezekiel chapter 1 verse 1, Now it came to pass in the 30th year in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river Kebar, that the heavens were opened. Another man sees into heaven, and I saw visions of God. Ezekiel witnesses the glory of the Lord. So let's get our bearings. Who's Ezekiel? Well, he's a priest and he's soon to become a prophet. Where did he grow up? In the land of Judah. Where is he now? Well, he's hundreds of miles away, in Babylon. What's he doing there? Well, he's been dragged off into exile by the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. Do you see? For Ezekiel, the unthinkable has happened. Judah has been conquered by the Babylonians. And while at this stage the temple and Jerusalem are still standing, Ezekiel, the king, and thousands of others are now in exile. Instead of the beautiful city, Ezekiel is living in a shanty town. Instead of the mountains of Jerusalem, he's dwelling on the arid plains of Babylon. Instead of the cooling springs, there is a river whose streams shall make glad the city of God. He's sitting by a stagnant canal, the river Kebar. And instead of Mount Zion, the city of the great king, the dwelling place of God himself, he's now living under the tyranny of Nebuchadnezzar. But far from home, he witnesses this extraordinary vision of the glory of the Lord. So please have Ezekiel chapter 1 open in front of you. Now, I wondered about the wisdom of tackling this passage on a Sunday morning. The expression wheels within wheels comes to mind. Of course it does, because we get that proverbial saying in English exactly from this passage. That's where it comes from. Verse 16, the appearance of their workings was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. I think it says in the Authorized Version, a wheel within a wheel. Here is something that's difficult to grasp, something difficult to get your mind round. Difficult to get a handle upon. It's a wheel within a wheel. We mustn't let the details of this vision obscure the wonder and glory of it all. Now somebody's thinking, okay, well, if this vision is so important, why is it so difficult to follow what Ezekiel is saying? Why can't, when you read through chapter 1, why can't he just sort of lay it out in a more orderly way, like a sort of car manual? Why can't he bring some precision to his observations? And in fact, commentaries tell me that the Hebrew here is very messy. It's disjointed. It's ungrammatical. It's just a tumble of words that are pouring out of Ezekiel's mouth. Now, why is it like that? Because what we have here is an eyewitness account. Ezekiel is simply describing what he sees as he sees it. It's a bit like a football commentator. Simply telling you what he sees with his eyes, trying to make sense of it all, caught up in the drama of the moment. I mean, this is not the final goal at Wembley, sealing an England victory in the World Cup final. This is a vision of God. And Ezekiel he's using earthly language to try and describe things that are heavenly. And he's trying to find the words. He hasn't got the words. He keeps saying, well, it's like this, and it's like that. Because earthly language describes earthly things. Here are things which are heavenly. And the man, as he's talking, he's overwhelmed. He's breathless. You can feel his pulse racing through this passage. By the end of which, he's collapsed face down. That's why in this chapter, he repeats himself. He leaves ends which are untied. He gives tantalizing descriptions. You think, hang on a minute, hold it there, Ezekiel, tell me more. I don't quite understand what you're saying, but he's moved on to something else. We're not, Christian friends, reading a car manual. We're stepping into the drama of a meeting with God. Okay, so we have three points this morning. Point number one, what does Ezekiel see? And we're going to go quite quickly so that we can We don't lose sight of the wood for the trees, if you see what I mean. What do you see, Ezekiel? Verse 4, then I looked, and behold, a whirlwind was coming out of the north, a great cloud with raging fire engulfing itself, and brightness was all around it, and radiating out of its midst like the color of amber out of the midst of the fire. So Ezekiel looks up, and in the distance, coming down from the north, he sees this great storm. Literally, it's a wind, it's a breath. It looks like an immense thundercloud. And as it approaches, he sees that it glows. It burns. There are flashes of lightning. And at its core is the radiance of molten metal, the color of amber. In the middle, it looks like a furnace. But it's coming nearer still. It's coming towards him. What can you see, Ezekiel? Verse 5, also from within it came the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. So first impressions, as he looked into the cloud, what do you see, Ezekiel? I see four living creatures. They're not just a vision or a projection. They're alive. He calls them living creatures. They're characterized by life. And overall, they look humanoid. They're not human, but they look more human than anything else. Verse 6, each one had four faces, and each one had four wings. And we're told of those wings, verse 11, that they're stretched out to touch the wings of the others. So these four living creatures, if you like, are arranged in a square, each one touching the wings of the other, the wingtips of the others. Arranged in a square, if you can get your mind around that. So with two wings, they touch two other wings, and with two wings, they cover their bodies, we're told in verse 11. And then verse 7, their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the soles of calves' feet. In other words, they looked very fleet of foot, very quick. And verse 8, the hands of a man were under their wings and on their four sides, and each of the four had faces and wings. So they have four wings, they have four sides, they have four hands, and they have four faces. Now before we look at the faces, note what it says in verse 9, the creatures did not turn when they went, but each one went straight forward. In other words, these creatures always face in the same direction. They never swivel round. They're always facing in the same direction. So as Ezekiel looks at these creatures, facing him, verse 10, is the face of a man. But then at right angles to that face, to the right of that face, is a face of a lion. And then to the left of that human face, at the other right angle, is the face of a bull. And at the back, although it's not the back, it's the other side, because their faces on all four sides, facing inwards, is the face of an eagle. But because they don't swivel, the face that's always looking out is the face of a man. Hence Ezekiel's first impression, verse 5. They had the likeness of a man. But actually, if you look at it, because their faces are on each of the four sides, you can actually see all four faces together, can't you? As the face of a man, if you look that way, you'll see the face of the eagle looking the other way, and you'll see on each side the face of a bull and the face of a lion. Well, as Ezekiel looks at these creatures, it's just a kaleidoscope of impressions. Verse 12, they're swept along by the Spirit. Verse 7, they sparkle like burnished bronze. In fact, when Ezekiel gets a closer look, they appear like burning coals. And these living creatures, they're constantly interacting. Verse 13, as for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, like the appearance of torches going back and forth among the living creatures. It's as though light is passing between the living creatures. They seem to be communicating, not with words, but light is moving between them. Have you ever looked into a fire? And if you're a fire of coals, and you'll see one coal glows, and while one coal glows, another one dims. And as you keep looking, the one that's just dimmed, that starts to glow, and this one dims. One is brightening, one is fading, one is brightening, one is fading. Is that the sense of what Ezekiel sees? One of these creatures burns brighter. One other one gets a little bit dimmer. But then this one starts to burn brighter while this one gets dimmer. And it's as though fire is passing between them. They seem to be constantly communicating, constantly interacting. Only it's light that's moving between them. So although they're distinct, four living creatures, they're not isolated. They're as one. And so verse 14, when they move together, they're so bright and they're so fast, they look like flashes of lightning. Can you imagine that? Living creatures. The speed at which they're moving, the brightness that they have, it's like a flash of lightning when they move. Extraordinary, isn't it? Imagine it. Can you see it? These burning beings within the cloud, and they're alive and glorious and dynamic, and there's movement, energy, vibrance, and they're radiating with a supernatural glory. And can't you feel Ezekiel's pulse quickening? It's getting nearer and nearer. But look now at verse 15. Now as I looked at the living creatures, behold, a wheel was on the earth beside each living creature with its four faces. So beside each living creature is a wheel. But it's not like the wheel of a bike. Verse 16, the appearance of the wheels and their workings was like the color of beryl. And all four had the same likeness. They all looked the same. The appearance of their workings was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. So here are these wheels, and they're described as having a wheel within a wheel. So we know what a gyroscope looks like. It's like that. If that doesn't make any sense to you, well, one wheel rim is going this way, and the other wheel rim is going that way. At right angles to each other. So one is going this way, and one is going that way. Like a rolling ball that pivots at the center. You get children's buggies these days, don't you? And at the front, instead of having wheels at the front, you have a ball, yes? And that ball is capable of universal movement. It can move in any direction, yes? Well, those four wheels, they're not a ball, but they're two intersecting rims. And they're capable of moving in any direction without having to turn them. Verse 17. When they moved, they went toward any one of four directions. They did not turn as they went. And these wheels, in Ezekiel's words, are awesome. Now, I know it's one of those words that people use these days, isn't it? You know, so I talk to younger people and they tell me things are awesome. Quite ordinary things are awesome. Well, here's something that really is awesome. Verse 18. As for their rims, they were so high, they were awesome. Here is something that really is awesome. And their rims were full of eyes all around the four of them. Think of it. Maybe these wheels are the size of the London Eye. So you're a little man and you're looking up at something that really is awesome. And the rims are not made of metal or rubber. But they're like a semi-precious stone. He describes it as being like beryl. It's a green stone. It's something very beautiful. And as they move on their rims, he says, well, it's like eyes. I think the sense of it is it's like cat's eyes. It's like glistening jewels. As these wheels turn, you just see like thousands, tens of thousands of glittering jewels. These immense, awesome wheels. Beautiful. And as they turn, it's just a color. The green and the glittering of the jewels is like thousands of eyes on the rim. And verses 19 to 21, there's a seamless relationship between the living creatures and the wheels. Beside each wheel is a living creature. He doesn't turn the wheel in a mechanical way, pull a lever, press something on the ground. There's no mechanical relationship between the living creature and the wheel. The living creature and the wheel are joined together by the same spirit. The wheel is almost an extension of the living creature. Verse 20, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. It looks as though, almost as though the wheels are alive. So where the creatures go, the wheels go. There's total coordination between the two. Sometimes the wheels are moving along the ground. But sometimes they lift off from the ground and they go through the air. Verse 21, And when those were lifted up, the living creatures lifting up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up together with them. For the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. So do you see? Four living creatures, four wheels. What is it? Well, it's an awesome, immense, fantastic chariot, isn't it? That's what it is. It's a chariot that's coming out of the north towards him. Extraordinary. And it can move in any direction. It can move in any dimension. It doesn't travel in silence. Look at verse 24. When they went, I heard the noise of their wings, like the noise of many waters, like the voice of the Almighty, a tumult, like the noise of an army. And when they stood still, they let down their wings. Think of it. There you are. You're not only dazzled by this kaleidoscope of color, but the sound of this chariot is like Niagara Falls. He says it's like hearing the voice of God. It's like a great army on the march. But all this begs the question, doesn't it? If this is just the chariot, if this is merely the chariot, who is the one who rides upon it? Okay, verse 22. Ezekiel looks and he sees stretched over the heads of these four living creatures what he describes as a firmament or an expanse or a dome, however you want to describe it. It's like a ceiling above their heads. And he says, well, I looked at it, it seemed to me that it was like the color of an awesome crystal. Something else that's awesome, isn't it? Maybe it looks like a sea of glass. So there's a ceiling over their heads. Not a glass ceiling, but a crystal ceiling. What's on the other side? And now we come to the climax of the vision. Because Ezekiel looks up. What's on the other side? And he sees outside this creation and he sees into heaven itself. A voice came from above the firmament that was over their heads. He hears a voice. When you hear a voice, your eyes go to where that voice is coming from, don't you? So when he hears a voice above the firmament, he looks up. His eyes follow the voice. What do you see, Ezekiel? Verse 26, and above the firmament, over their heads, was the likeness of a throne, in appearance like a sapphire throne. It's a brilliant, beautiful, rich, blue sapphire throne. And who's seated upon it? Verse 26. On the likeness of the throne was a likeness with the appearance of a man high above it. Ezekiel sees the king. Verse 27. Also from the appearance of his waist and upward, I saw as it were the color of amber, with the appearance of fire all around within it. And from the appearance of his waist and downward, I saw, as it were, the appearance of fire with brightness all around. When he sees the king is like a consuming fire. It's like glistening metal, the color of amber. And around him, like a mantle radiating out, verse 28, is a rainbow. Do you see? Who is this burning being that shines with the brightness of the glory of God? That in appearance is surpassingly beautiful. The beauty of holiness. Who is this one who makes visible in the likeness of a man the invisible God? It's the only begotten of the Father. It's the eternal Son. The second person of the Godhead. It's the Word who was in the beginning, who was with God, who was God. Verse 28, this was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And all Ezekiel can do is fall on his face. Okay, point number two. Let's try and make sense of this chariot. Here's this awesome, immense, fantastic chariot. What are we to think? These living creatures, what are they? Well, later on, because Ezekiel will this chariot will come again to Ezekiel in chapter 10, he describes them as cherubim. That's what they are. Here they're just living creatures. Later on he'll describe them as cherubim. These are angelic beings. Are they merely symbolic? No. Ezekiel stresses, doesn't he, that they're alive, and from within it came the likeness of four living creatures. They're real enough. And when you look at them, strange and wonderful as they are, there is a common theme about them. Did you spot it? There's this repetition of the number four. There are four of them. They have four sides. They're tetraploid. They have four wings, four hands, four faces. The number that's repeated again and again is four. Well, what's the significance of the number four in Scripture? Four in Scripture invariably refers or speaks of creation. There's a river that flows out of Eden and it splits into four rivers that water the earth. There are the four winds, the four seasons, the four corners of the earth. Again and again in Scripture, four comes back as speaking of this world, this creation. The implication, therefore, being that these cherubim represent in some way this creation, the living world. Hence their four faces, an eagle, a bull, a lion. Speaking of creation, and particularly the face of a man. Do you remember God's command to Adam? Fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Adam's commission is to humanize creation. He's to bring all creation under his dominion. It's all to come under his feet. All creation is to bear Adam's image. Hence, if the cherubim represent the living world, a world that's to be under the dominion of man, they will, above all other things, look human. And this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. So cherubim represent creation. And if time could be permitted, we could explore this further. We haven't got the time, but some of you might like to look up things like Psalm 18, verse 10, or 2 Samuel 22, verse 11, because there seems to be a very real relationship between this natural, chemical, biological, physical, ecological world, the creation that we see, and these glorious angelic beings that we don't see. In Scripture, there seems to be a relationship between them, that this visible creation has an invisible angelic dimension. Perhaps we could talk about that, discuss that another time. It's interesting to look into it and think about it. Anyway, if these creatures represent this creation, who's ruling over it? Who's ruling over this creation? Who rides upon it? Who's enthroned above the living world? Whose spirit harnesses it and animates it and turns it wherever he wishes? It's the Lord, isn't it? The Lord is in creation, his spirit is animating it, and yet he's seated in the highest heaven above creation. He's on the other side of the firmament, enthroned over all. And he rides the chariot, if you like, of this creation, wherever he pleases. And above the firmament, over their heads, was the likeness of a throne. In appearance like a sapphire stone, on the likeness of the throne was the likeness with appearance of a man high above it. The Lord enthroned over creation. Now think of the impact that would have upon Ezekiel. Where is he? He's a captive, isn't he? He's a captive in Babylon. He's under the rule of Nebuchadnezzar. And never was a rule so absolute or so glorious as Nebuchadnezzar's. You remember Daniel's vision. He has his vision of this great figure who has a head of gold. And then chest of arms of silver, and so it goes down to eventually feet of clay. And the head of gold, we're told, is Nebuchadnezzar and his kingdom. The Babylonian kingdom had a glory that surpassed any other kingdoms, any other empires. His rule really was absolute. Now, have you seen Babylonian art? You can Google it, you can come up with pictures of it. Such living creatures, like somewhat described here, they appear again and again in Babylonian art, in depictions of carvings and statues and so on. Nebuchadnezzar himself would have probably been seated on a throne molded into which were angels. Sometimes they're called sphinxes. You've seen them. They usually have a head of a man, the body of a lion or a bull, and the wings of an eagle. In other words, symbolically, Nebuchadnezzar behaved and thought of himself as the supreme ruler. He rules over all. After all, not even the God of Israel can stand against him. He saw himself seated on his throne, underneath him, these sphinxes. He saw himself as the Lord of creation, that he himself, Nebuchadnezzar, rides upon creation. But does he? Are his angels real? Do they move? Does he ride upon them, turning them wherever he wishes? Is Nebuchadnezzar seated in the highest heaven? Not just on top of the world, but above the world. Does he ride upon the throne chariot? Is the creation subject to him? All Nebuchadnezzar can do is make Airfix models to try and look like the real thing. But they're not the real thing, are they? Because he's not the real king. It's the Lord. He's the king. He does ride upon a chariot. Creation is under his feet. He does turn it wherever he wishes. His spirit does animate it. It moves, and yet he rules over it. And he turns creation to do whatever he wills, to serve his purposes, to serve his glory. Don't you think that would have been a comfort to Ezekiel? To understand that, to begin to grasp that, he may be a captive in Babylon, he may be under the rule of Nebuchadnezzar, but there is one who really does ride upon a chariot in which are living seraphim, living cherubim. He serves the one who really is the Lord. Okay, well now point number three. What has this vision got to teach us? Number one. This vision teaches us that God is transcendent. Now look at the language in this chapter. A whirlwind. A great cloud. A raging fire. Lightning. Living creatures with a strange and wonderful glory, whose wing beat sounds like the voice of God. And this chariot, these gigantic wheels that really are awesome, whose rim is full of sparkling jewels as it moves. But if we're looking up and looking in, our eye is drawn, isn't it, to that ceiling, that barrier, that firmament. It's the color of an awesome crystal. And our eye is drawn to what is on the other side. And we're now, as we look on the other side of that crystal ceiling, we're now looking outside this creation, aren't we? We're now looking beyond this creation, and we're looking into heaven itself. And as we look into heaven itself, our eyes go higher. And what do we see? We see this vast, immense, awesome throne that's the color of sapphire. And one who sits upon it, whose appearance is like a consuming fire, and he's robed in the beauty of a rainbow. And we're looking in, and we find ourselves looking up, and Christian friends, the altitude, and the distance, and the exaltation, and the transcendence. And we see the one who sits over and reigns over and sits above the universe. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. Now, have you ever been for a strenuous walk? And you've stumbled up a steep slope and you've battled through the undergrowth just to see a view, just to contemplate the beauty of a sunset. Just to see the grandeur of a mountain. And it was hard work, wasn't it? But when you got there, and you saw it, and you ask of it nothing, just a view, and yet it fills you with wonder, so much so that you don't want to leave it, you don't want to turn away. So you take a photograph of it so you can take it home with you. We all do that, we all know that, don't we? Now, such efforts don't seem to be strange, do they? But Christian friends, what efforts do I make to contemplate the Lord of creation, the maker of all these things, the one who rides upon all these things? Coming to him, not because I want something from him, but simply to come and to gaze and to worship and to adore. Asking of him nothing. And yet as I contemplate him, finding my soul is abundantly satisfied. It's been filled with a fullness that isn't from this world, that nothing this world can fill. And I've asked of him nothing, but in the worship of him, in being still and knowing that he is God, I've been filled with his fullness. And my lips are brought to say, oh, how great thou art. Oh, worship the King. The transcendence of God. When did you last dwell? Stop. Take your eyes off all the things that are here. When did you last dwell upon his beauty and his glory and his majesty? The contemplation of God. When did that last keep you awake at night? If I gave you a check for £1 million and it was real, that'd keep you awake for a night, wouldn't it? For the contemplation of God. When did you last? I can't sleep. God is here. I've seen something of his glory. Transcendence of God. Some of you know Stephen Lansdorne and his sweetheart, Cicely. She died a month ago. Do you know what was on Stephen's heart, even after the funeral? He said that I might know him. Oh, that I might know him better. And he said this, he said, when I was younger, he said, there were so many things I thought they were important. And I used to worry about them. And I used to fret over them. And he said, I've wasted so much time worrying and fretting over things that don't matter at all. They never mattered. What once seemed important doesn't seem important anymore. Now you might say, well, he's come to the end of his life. But what gives a man that perspective? What gives a man that perspective is being still in the presence of God. It's the contemplation of the transcendence of God. That's what gives you that view. And Christian friend, how often we live as beggars, and we do, because we're so filled with ourselves. We're so stuffed full of the things that are around us, so full of our own dreams and plans and schemes. And we say, well, what's in it for me? And what about me? And this is what I want. And we live as beggars because of it. And we live as though we've never seen God. But to see God, to contemplate his transcendence, it shrinks down all those things so they can no longer survive. And only one thing then seems important. Lord, for your glory. That's the only maxim I can now live by. For your glory. So whether I'm eating or drinking or whatever it might be, it's for your glory. Nothing else matters. Christian friend, when did you last lift your eyes above this world to see the Lord of glory? And number two, God is sovereign. What is he sitting on? He's sitting on a throne, a sapphire throne. It's high, it's above everything else. It's not part of this creation, it's above this creation. He really is the King, isn't he? He's the final, unchallengeable authority. He rules over all. He's answerable to no one. This created realm is animated by his spirit, and he turns it wherever he wills to do whatever he pleases. That chariot can move in any dimension, can't it? It can go up and down and north, south, east, and west. In other words, that chariot being able to move anywhere, it's saying there are no outposts to God's dominion. There are no frontiers to his rule. He really is sovereign. He's the Alpha, the Omega, the Infinite, the Absolute. He's the King. And number three, God is transcendent, God is sovereign, and God is here. Ezekiel is far from the holy temple, he's far from the holy land, he's an exile, probably feels he's a reject. By now, at the age of 30, he should have been entering the priesthood. Instead, he's been abandoned in a foreign land. It's been 5 years since he was in Judah. Has God abandoned him? Has God been defeated? And you get the sense with Ezekiel, he says, well, I don't know. I don't know whether God has been defeated, whether he has been overthrown. But what I do know is that God is far away. Is he? Is he far away, Ezekiel? The Lord is here. A chariot that carries his throne, is there anywhere it can't go? Is there any border that it cannot cross? Ezekiel, the Lord is here. Even in Babylon, because he is everywhere present. Now, Christian friend, like Ezekiel, has the unthinkable happened? Have your dreams turned to ashes? Do you find yourself this morning in a place not of your choosing? I don't want to be in this place that I find myself. And you feel a victim of events. You think, how did I end up here in this way? Well, the sovereign Lord is here. You remember Jacob running away from home. Comes to a deserted wilderness. Everything's gone wrong, isn't it? He goes to sleep. He dreams. Dreams of that ladder. Angels ascending and descending on the ladder. And he wakes up. And what does he say? He says, surely the Lord is in this place. And I didn't know it. Christian friend, God is here. God is always here. Are you feeling abandoned? Well, you may not know it. But the Lord is in this place. He's the sovereign Lord. He's here. You're not living out plan B. God is transcendent. God is sovereign. God is here. Moving on quickly, God speaks. Look at verse 28 again. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. So when I saw it, I fell on my face. And I heard a voice of one speaking. And he said to me, Son of man, stand on your feet, and I will speak to you. Yes, it's right that Ezekiel falls on his face before the king. But he's not to stay there. He's not a beast. He's a man. He's made in the image of God. He's made upright. He's made to walk with God. He's made for fellowship. He's been made to hear the voice of the king and to respond. And Christian friends, Ezekiel's privilege is our privilege, isn't it? How well we know this king will depend on how well we respond to his word. We do fall on our faces and worship, but he calls us also to stand on our feet, to walk with him, to hear his voice. So how well do you respond to the voice of the king? The God who speaks tells us with whom he will dwell. This is what he says. He said, heaven is my throne, and earth is my footstool. Where is the house that you will build for me? Where is the place of my rest? For all these things my hand has made, and all those things exist, says the Lord. But on this one will I look. This is the one I'm going to dwell with, says God. This is the one I'm going to walk with. But on this one I will look, on him who is poor and of a contrite spirit and who trembles at my word. God is transcendent. God is sovereign. God is here. God speaks. And finally, God dwells among us. Now witness his glory. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And yet who would think that this same Lord should be conceived in the womb of a virgin, that he should live among us, and throughout those 33 years his glory veiled, and that this king should go to the cross. And on the cross we witness an unimagined glory, don't we? That he should die, that he should suffer, that he should shed his blood for the sins of his people. What glory is that? An unimagined glory. Who would think that God would come in flesh and die to redeem his people? And then we understand, don't we, when Paul says, truly great is the mystery of godliness, that God manifested in the flesh. An unimagined glory of the God who dwells among us. God is transcendent. God is sovereign. God is here. God speaks. And God dwells among us. Christian friends, I've been reading a little book by Bob Dickey on worship. It's been very good. And this is the thought that comes out of it. Your Christian life, the spiritual life of this church, will never rise above our view of God. Is this the God that you worship?